Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. My name is. Oh, it's just not going to work at all. Never accept a dare from Mark Walsh. Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. My name is Leslie Kaminoff, and you may know me as the co-author of the international bestseller, Yoga Anatomy. But I'm also the co-founder of yogaanatomy.net. Now that's a platform we built 11 years ago, where we offer online courses and in-depth anatomy modules that support teachers, teacher trainings, and students all over the world. So that's why we are thrilled to be sponsoring all the incredible sessions here on the Yoga Channel, including my own. And if you feel a connection with the way I teach, I have some great news for you. We are extending scholarships to all members of the Embodiment Conference. And you can find that scholarship info and links to yogaanatomy.net in the description for this presentation and in the show notes. In the meantime, enjoy your body, enjoy your breath, and enjoy your conference. And I'll see you online.
Okay, so Gary, I'd love to introduce you now to our session today on embodying tensegrity. So Gary has a very rich bio, and so I've just picked out four things from it that I was particularly interested in. And they're all around your passion for movement. The first one is your experience with more than 35 years of experience, and is internationally recognized as a leading movement and anatomy teacher. The other one is about your training. In 1991, Gary created Natural Bodies based on his own techniques for movement integration training, and also taught with Tom Myers from 1997 onwards on the UK's first anatomy trains programs. Dissection, a love of mine. Gary teaches dissection on his courses, and he was involved with creating the world's first plastinated human, working with Günther von Hagen's team in Germany. He was the lead dissector and designer. And lastly, your book, Gary. Gary's got a book coming out next year called The Anatomy Slings, and I'm assuming there's a pun on that title. So there's those things. And so I'm really delighted to introduce Gary to you now. Gary, over to you.
Great, thank you very much. Well, welcome everybody. This session, the first part of this session is gonna be part of a slideshow, and then we'll get into some ideas of movement as well. As I was saying at the beginning of this in the preamble before we started, I'm used to doing much longer sessions, so trying to cram this into just under an hour is going to be an interesting feat, so I might have to skip over some of the stuff with the slideshow as well. But I've got a screen share here, and I'll go through some of what was introduced as well at the beginning, but also make a few corrections to that beginning too. So here we go. Hopefully that can be seen. Ed, I can see you and Norman. Can you see my slideshow? Okay, great. Oh, that's cool. Okay, so let's start off here. Okay, so here I am. We're going to be looking at embodying tensegrity. And one thing I'd like to start with here is that from my perspective, we're all embodied. I think we're born all embodied. And what we're looking for really is to kind of uncover the stuff that might cover it up rather than trying to add more to it. But an interesting quote here, I think, from a Tai Chi saying, really, is that in any action, the whole body must be made as light as a feather and free moving as possible, so light that the addition of a feather would be felt for its weight, and so free moving that a fly cannot alight on it without setting it in motion. And to me, that really just says so much about what's happening with the qualities of motion within our structure. And the more I've gone down the route of what I've been doing in my life, finding this quality of lightness and fluidity in the system is becoming even more and more important. I come from a varied background, as was sort of loosely introduced, is that judo, Wing Chun, various kung fu practices, my good friend Rupert in the middle there, who appeared with me sneakily on the last embodiment conference, competition athletics and cycling and so on, bodybuilding, which is how natural bodies started. But the common thread to it was always the spine. One of my cycling coaches, when I was a teenager, really started to teach us about the importance of the elasticity of the spine. And that became a thread through lots of practices that I really started getting involved in as my kind of professional life, really, in terms of studying shiatsu. Through shiatsu, we had an extensive qigong practice. With that, studying cranial sacral therapy and the spine's quality, and that became important. And then I came across the work of Vander Scarabelli in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And again, the thread to that was the importance of the spine. And it was a good friend of mine, Peter Blackaby, who's also teaching on this conference, that really got me interested and introduced me deeper into that work. And then I met John Sterk, who just blew my mind in understanding what's going on with the motion of the body. And it was John Sterk in the early 90s that introduced the word fascia to me. And we started getting quite interested in the connective tissue quality of the body and how it moved, and its rhythmic quality and its fluid nature, which we don't hear a lot spoken about in terms of motion. And at the bottom there is Diane Long, who's been one of my long-term teachers based on Vander Scarabelli's work. But also, as was mentioned, I worked with Tom Myers. We introduced him to Brighton, which is where I am right now. And Mark Walsh is just up the road from here, in fact. and Tom came to Natural Bodies and we did some work together, and then gradually got more interested in that work. And I ended up studying with him and co-taught with him on some of the anatomy training sessions we used to have in my studio in Brighton. And I got involved in his first book in doing some of the body reading work and illustrations for him. These are just a couple of the centers here, from 91 through to 2013 as a center. Now, center doesn't exist. I'm sort of more free agent with it, but the business name still exists. But with that, we had the original movement. Mark's kind of taken that word now. And we had a group of people that we used to practice with a lot over a good period of time, where we used to kind of pull all our ideas together and then take that out there into the world and see what differences that would make to ourselves, how we embodied those practices, and then took that out into teaching. So I'm still in touch with a good group of these people, and we still work quite closely together. I'm also part of the Fascia Research Society, as that work's gone deeper, and I'm involved in, I'm one of the lead dissectors in the Fascial Net Plastination Project. And the full body form has been completed in dissection, but has not been completed in plastination yet, but we got involved in creating some pieces for a conference that occurred in 2018 in Berlin. I think one of my colleagues on here, one of my top dissectors, Jahan Adam, is, I think, is watching us today as well. So I run a series of courses, myofascial experiential myofascial anatomy for movement teachers. And I've got a good team of people that have been working alongside me on those courses as well. Some of these names you might recognize. And then again, this takes me back into Vander's work, because these sort of works coincide. There's something about Vander's work that really made a lot of sense as to what I started to understand in terms of the fascial quality of movement. She was taught by Iyengar and also Desika Chah, and those two were both taught by Krishnamacharya, and he used to teach the individuals based around their own body. So he wasn't necessarily teaching a system. Of course, some of these other individuals created systems of their own practices, but one thing with Vander's work is that there was no system behind it. And also, I've got the woman here, Indra Devi, was the only female that was taught by Krishnamacharya, and she ended up taking her work off to South America, so we don't know too much about the rest of that lineage. But she had an interesting quote, Vander: movement is the song of the body. However, this one started to make a lot of sense to me, is going with the body and not against it. And every time I start going through my own practices today, this still keeps ringing true in my mind as to how we follow the quality of movement in the system. But also, this really started to make sense to me when it came to dissection work as well. The moment we start peeking under the tissues, we start to realize this is the landscape of shape. But a big element of her work was gravity, and some underlying principles here is breath, gravity, and spine. And I love that image of the word gravity there. That's the gravity bar in the Guinness factory in Ireland. I'm a Guinness drinker. It's a good gravity drink, by the way. But the interesting thing with that is that the arrows are pointing upwards. And so there's this sort of consideration that gravity is a pushing force rather than a pulling force. And those that have been on my courses, we explore that a lot in depth, as this understanding of gravity being this pushing force And I love those two images, really, but one of the statue there, but also the goats, the mountain goats, how they manage that from understanding gravity is beyond me. An interesting quote from physiologist W.C. McKenzie is, if generalizations were to be made about the cause of human disease, it would be along the line of failure to accommodate the erect posture. And Judith Aston was talking about this in one of her sessions with Mark Walsh, is that, you know, this ground reaction force is as we start to move well within gravity, the body can move fluidly. But the moment we start to move out of gravity, we've got a lot more forces working against us. And the reason I got this image up is that when I spent time in Florence studying with one of Vander's long-term students, I would go here. I'd love the statue of David. I've always appreciated Michelangelo's work. And Vander was always asked, why are these pieces here? These pieces lining the corridor that are unfinished. And Vander, with a brush of the hand, used to say, oh, they're not in the gravity. And you could start to see, and me coming from a design and graphics background originally, is that, of course, if he'd tried to finish those sculptures, they didn't sit quite right. They wouldn't fit right with how they sat in gravity. They would almost look uncomfortable there. So they're almost a bit like discarded drawings, pretty heavy drawings to discard though. By the time he gets down to his final piece, which is at the end of the corridor, the beautiful statue of David. And I love this quote from Steve Paxton. This was a book given to me by my good friend and colleague, Colleen Bartley. And this is beautiful. Birth is not so much a beginning as it is an abrupt change in which suddenly there are different factors than those in the womb. And then there is gravity. With gravity, a new negotiation begins, and these terms condition us for the rest of our lives. Every moment of our life, we're dealing with that force. Yeah, it's the constant force, really, that we're working with. So how do those forces act upon us all the time? I'm going to move into fascia for a moment here, and we can't really talk about fascia without looking at one of the first people that started bringing this kind of language of fascia into light. It was the founder of osteopathy, Andrew Taylor Still, and he really started getting quite exploratory around the fascia and was suggesting all sorts of different qualities of the fascia that he couldn't necessarily prove, the suggestion that it might be neurological in nature, the suggestion that it might be a mediator for movement of fluids and electrolytes. And over the last 30, 40 years or so, these things have really been proven to be true. So the guy was sort of spot on in his understandings. This is a quote from a good friend of mine, a man called David Lazondak. He was interviewed by my friend Stephen Braybrook in 2018. Collectively, if you look at the fascia covering the bones, the fascia covering the muscles, covering the nerve, fascia covering organs, not to mention covering tendons and ligaments, which are really thickenings of the fascia, which is how it specializes, fascia becomes a body-wide tensional system, stroke network, communicating mechanical information throughout the whole organism, including your brain, which I think, I mean, with that sentence, he kind of nailed it for me, but also the moment, including your brain. We do understand that there's this sort of relationship between the brain and the fascia and the brain. And whatever we start doing with the motion of the body is affecting the way that we behave. And also the way that we behave is affecting the motion of the body. But fascia is not about where, it's about how. How is it? And here we've got an interesting individual, Emma Bharati, who has done something deliberately to his fascial structure. And some of you have seen these sadhus at the Kumbh Mela, these huge events in India, where his belief system is putting the arm up, and part of his route to enlightenment is this particular suffering in such way that he leaves the arm up and doesn't do anything else other than leave it there. When he goes to sleep, it has to be tied into a little rope loop above the head. So he's never bringing that down. So he's made a change to his structure. Here we see him as a much younger person, that black and white image, and of course we see him in his recent years. He's been doing this for about 50 years. Well, I say doing it, he's not doing it anymore. He's actually maintained keeping the arm up there so that the tissues have then reorganized themselves. So under specific loads, under specific stasis, we'll start to see that the tissues will have to reorganize to prevent the structure from moving. Also, as you can see with the middle image, the arm atrophies a lot. So that the moment we start to reduce muscle mass, what's known is that as muscle mass reduces, we increase the laydown of collagen. So the structure becomes stiffer and denser. So there's no way that's going to move. If I tried to move the arm down, he would turn around with it, or I would break something, and I wouldn't necessarily want to do that with him. But also, it's too late for him to say, you know what, I've given up on my faith right now. I don't like that. He can't bring the arm down anymore. End of story. It stays there. And of course, the whole body is adapted to that. It is, however, is very different. This is a pliable structure. And in fact, if we were to look at his joints with a microscope, you might see a bit of space in those joints because they're hanging quite well. And gravity is pressing up to him as much as he's meeting the branch. I just go back to our colleague here. If we were to look at his joint structures, you'd find that those spaces of the joints are pretty much compressed probably. So this is an image from Robert Schleip's team or from his work and his colleagues. Is the image on the left is where we see some fascial tissue that's been seen under an electron microscope, where in fact it was a camera that was put under the skin with a guy that had his arm broken, not on purpose, it was an accident, but there was part of a research that was going on looking at the tissue damage in that particular area. So here we're looking at the fascial laydown. This is before this individual's arm went into a plaster cast. And when we look at the image on the right-hand side, this is 6 to 8 weeks later or so when the arm has come out of the plaster cast, and you can see how the tissue has thickened and densified. And the language that's used with this from Carla Stecco and Antonio Stecco in their research is that densification is the language that's used in how the tissue starts to lay itself down. Now, of course, with regular movement work and physio, we would see that the tissue would start to reorganize itself back to probably what the first picture would be like. And who knows, maybe different to that again. So movement is the key really to start to lay down different arrangements of those tissues. And here where we start to look at these very, very sort of schematic illustrations, and we look at the bottom one, where we see the image from the anatomy of movement from Calais-Germain Blandin's work, we can see a good covering of the fascial tissue around the muscle. And that in fact, from the fascial tissue around the muscle, the epimysium blends and becomes part of the tendon, and the tendon then becomes part of the periosteum, which is on the bone and the image on the right. So that's all one continuum. So the action of the tissue pulling, or the muscular tissue pulling on the periosteum, is going to eventually start to create forces through the bone, and genetically over its evolution has generated various shapes and bumps and curves within the bone as well. But here we look at some work from, this is from Tom Meyer's first Anatomy Trains edition. We can see how a possible heel spur is formed, where the plantar fascia has been pulling at the periosteum lining of the heel and gently started to pull that away. And you start to see that the tissue grows into that shape. Here, we've got an image from classic thoracic vertebral area. And we can see the bottom image where there's been some strain. So that person was in a kyphotic position where they're bent forwards. And of course, the load has changed through the bony structure. If I show you this, these are a couple of my vertebrae, well, not my own, the models. the one on the left is a plastic one. Now these plastic models are molded from human bodies, and that's T5. So that's the fifth thoracic vertebra. So you can see it's got a pretty healthy looking shape to it. The one on the right is from a real spine that I've got. It's a very old skeletal structure I've got there. That's T5. Look at the shape of it. It's compressed towards the front. You can see that there's curves that are appearing towards the front, lipping, and then there's a bone spur towards the back. And we know from that one vertebra that this individual had a scoliosis. And of course, that's confirmed when all the vertebral pieces go together. So that under specific load over a prolonged period of time, the structure reorganizes itself against those sort of forces. So it's kind of interesting as to how the structure has to manage that. It's not just muscular tissue that's going to change. It's not just fascial tissue that's going to change. It's also going to be the bony development too. So I've been doing a lot of work over this over the years and exploring these sort of regions of the body. And this is something that was quite an astounding figure, really, about 160,000 hip and knee joint replacements each year in England and Wales. Now, what's causing this? This is the bone that gets the most replacements, the top and the bottom of it. And some people say, well, it's sort of disorganization of movement. And another client of mine said, well, it could be user error. You know, how do we start to organize ourselves with that structure? If you look at the top of this and the bottom of this bone, it's rounded. And we know that joint surfaces are slippery than ice on ice. So you've got a femur with a ball on the top, similar size as a golf ball. And at the bottom end, and this is a, some sayings from Bonnie Bainbridge-Cohen, who was interviewed by Mark some time ago, is that the knee joint can be considered a double ball and socket. And that is now something that is being considered out there in the movement world. So you've got balls at the top and the bottom of this. It's not a good weight bearer. And from these recent studies, or quite a few years ago, in fact, is that we're beginning to live in a time where we're seeing more yoga injuries than ever recorded. Now, of course, more people are doing yoga as well. But why would there need to be these sort of injuries? And some of the common sites of injury here are labral tears at the front of the hip and meniscus tears at the knee. And a few colleagues of mine and a sort of orthopedic surgeon at the top there, Dr. David Barrett, came into one of our dissection labs one time, and then me and a colleague of mine, Julian Baker, and he invited us to go and see some knee joint and hip joint surgeries because he was interested in the work that we were doing around the knee. And he said, listen, the problem of a lot of joint conditions is compression. And then he said, I've got a theory, the knee joint is an organ. And I'd heard this a few times before. We see here, John Sturck is saying, can we consider organs, joints as organs of separation, which I think is such a beautiful description of the joint structure. And then Bonnie Bainbridge-Cohen, joints are potentials for movement. And then Dr. Jaap van der Waal, the knee joint is an organ that happens to behave like a hinge. Joints are a lifelong process of maintaining space. How do we maintain space? So Jaap van der Waal came up with an interesting finding. And this wasn't initially accepted when he first came up with it, which is something that he called a dynamen. And I'm going to go through this in a very simple term here, in a simple way. These are from some sketches I quickly threw together yesterday and photographed to put into the presentation. We have two bones. Let's say this could be the knee joint, for instance. And then you've got a wrapping around it, which is the periosteum lining. That periosteum lining is continuous to make the joint capsule. And also we've got the cartilaginous ends. Within the joint structure, as a lot of you know, we've got synovial fluid, but the synovial fluid is contained in that joint capsule and it's pressurized. So it's called hydrostatic pressure. It's pressing the two bone ends apart ever so slightly. So there's a gap that would happen there. It's not a huge gap, not as much as this drawing. But then we look at the image on the right, we look at the green. These are the outlines for the fascial structure that would make up the musculature. So let's get busy on that. We can add the tendons to it, which blend to the periosteum of the bone. We had the muscle tissue in there. And then we see an area that will be called a ligament. Now the ligament we know is continuous with part of the joint capsule. It's a thickening within the joint capsule. What the dissector does, or the anatomist does, is cut it out and makes it separate or removes everything that doesn't look like a ligament. But Jaap van der Waal decided to dissect these things differently and remove a lot of the muscular tissue, but keep most of the fascia in place. And he found that there was an architecture from the underside of the muscular structure down towards the joint capsule. It's a continuum. It's the same fascial structures, just the architecture of it is different. So maybe not so much a ligament, but the ligamentous structure is continuous to the muscular structure and the tendinous structure. So that possibly when the muscular structures are engaging, they're pressurizing around the joint. And as they're pressurizing around the joint, around its sides, that's increasing the intra-joint pressure. So maintaining that hydrostatic pressure to keep the joint afloat rather than being a compressed structure. Bones don't touch. They've got space between them. The only bones that touch are the ones in the inside of your ear. But also here, you can see these little dashes that I've put near where the cartilage is. There's a man called Gerald Pollack who wrote a book called Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life. And he was looking at the nature of the fluids in the body. So he was looking at what's known as structured water and had found that at the cartilaginous level, there's a charge in the ions in the synovial fluid that creates a negative charge. And in the center of that structure is creating a positive charge. So the result is that the two ends of the bones are maintaining distance between them, a bit like holding the opposing ends of a magnet towards each other and they don't quite touch. Can we consider that could be the space that's occurring within the joint, and that the joint has now got a two or threefold method of maintaining space. That's available, that potential is available with every joint in the body. And here from Dr. David Barrett's findings is that he also said when he mentioned the joint, knee joint being an organ, I asked him why. And he said, well, we found that the cruciate ligament has actually got a percentage of nerve endings in it, they're proprioceptive, and this is now being found at the ligamentum teres, which is at the hip joint. So where you've got the knee joint and the hip joint, what we wouldn't want to do is to compress them. They're not good load bearers. And the moment we try to load bear them, they start to break down. So again, can we generate the conditions for space? So it comes back to these sayings once again. So joint surfaces, slipperier than ice on ice. And this takes me to, I was teaching in the Isle of Man and I took a photograph of, in fact, film this. This is a one-ton granite ball in a socket being moved by water pressure. So that structure isn't touching, it's floating, it's gliding. So if we think about the human form, then what would be happening there? Can we maintain the space? That's a ball and socket joint. Now this dynamite idea, where we've got these sheaths around joints that are maintaining pressure, could be considered around the spine. There's a lot of fascia around the spine. The spine doesn't look like these bumpy spine things that you see as plastic models. When we get into it in dissection, it's wrapped with an enormous amount of tissue. And that tissue sheaths the spine, and it's really strong. If the spine's able to lengthen, which is a premise of Van Descarrivelli's work, was definitely a premise within Joseph Pilates' work, as the spine lengthens, maybe that structure is gathering a pressure around the spine to increase the space within the discs once again. Can we set up the conditions for that when we start to move? So along with that, we've got the tensional aspect of the spine as well, so that the bony structures of the spine aren't necessarily touching just from the way that the muscular structure is organized. And you can see on the right here is a tensegrity spine. These ideas are also considered in the sheaths around the limbs too. So here we've got a couple of images from Frank Netter's illustrations of cross sections of the leg, and then from our fascial net placination project, where we see the original dissection at the top, the placinated version at the bottom there. Tom Myers borrowed one of our images for his presentation recently. And you can see the lining around that is a fascial lining around the leg. So when the musculature engages, what it does is it draws the fascia to it to increase the pressure. So they're considered to be hydraulic amplifiers to maintain uplift in the system. And the same is true here when we start to look at the side of the leg. We all used to seeing this white strip down the outside of the leg, but this iliotibial band is not a separate structure. It's actually part of a continuum. So this is part of the planning that was done for one of the pieces that we did in the placinarium once again. So the image on the right is the placinated piece. So the gluteal blends into the whole sheath, and that whole sheath encapsulates the entire leg. So maybe the gluteus maximus is not the gluteus maximus. We call it a tensor fascia lata maximus because it's pulling up on that entire sheath and creating this pressure once again. So there's multiple ways to create buoyancy. These pieces were presented in Berlin at the World Fascia Congress, where we had lots of very interesting people coming to look at that. Gil Heddy, you recognize in the middle there as well. Also, the work got into the Massage and Bodywork magazine, and my colleague Jahan's hands are at the top there. Also, we managed to get some of this published in my friend Linus Johansson's book, and Linus has been presenting on the Congress as well. Excuse me. And also, when you catch up on this, if you go back to the recording, you put your phone over this and you'll get some information about the Congress and the presentation that we did in the Congress in Berlin. From Tom Myers, the body is considered to have 600 individual muscles. The reality is it's one muscle folded about 600 times in different directions of pull. So here we start to look at this sort of idea, and I love that image from Gunther von Hagen's work, where the skeleton and the soft tissue are separated from each other. It's the same body. One of those can move, the other one can't. One's dependent upon the other, though the bones are suspended within that structure. But also we see this, and this is an illustration from the 1800s. And these are the fascial compartments of the inner thigh. And what we can start to see here is that where we see those white lines, if I was to redraw that, maybe I'll put a little gap into those white lines, because what we've got really is a soft joint network here. These structures can glide gently across each other. And where they glide, you've got fluid. So you're similar to a synovial joint, not exactly the same. We're looking for gliding surfaces. Between those gliding surfaces is a kind of a gooey, fluidy medium, which Gil Headley talks about as perifascia, which he was mentioning on his talk the other day. is that we've got these surfaces that can glide to generate motion. Where they don't, it starts to limit the quality of motion in the system. And it's organized, it could be organized in layers. They connect to each other through the layers, but they do permit motion at each level. And as Gil has mentioned before, maybe the true anatomy of movement exists in where the surfaces are. We have these surroundings around the entire structure. The image on the left is courtesy of Robert Schleip. And it's this whole body stocking, which we could say is a whole dynamite of the whole body. When it engages, when the musculature engages, it pulls it tighter to itself to increase the pressure to maintain buoyancy. And we recognize that in creatures, animals. Pandiculation is the term, and it's that sort of active yawning. So when we yawn, the whole structure is starting to open up and we extend through everything. You don't really repress it. Think about the energy it takes to repress a yawn, I can't even say the word. So gradually, can the structure start to open and extend, and it meets a moment in time and then retracts back once again. What about our practice having that quality to it, rather than doing something like dog pose and trying to hold it? Can it pass through its period of time and then disappear once again? Cats also, you can see, do dog pose, so do horses, so why call it dog? Pandiculation also, there was a lot of study done on this by a colleague of mine, Luis Fernando Bertolucci, and we were looking into the membranes. I was talking to this a lot about the membranes that exist under the skin, and it's those membranes that are really influenced in pandiculation. So I'm going to move on here. In fact, I'll go back to here. Just under the skin, we start to look at superficial fascia. Gil Headley was talking about this the other day. And when you remove the fatty tissue out from the stuff under the skin, you're left with a matrix. And that matrix is really strong. Components of our connective tissue, a lot of you know this, collagen, elastin, reticulin, living in a fluid medium called ground substance, glycoaminoglycans. So it's got this kind of mucus type base to it. As Tom Meyer says, to put it simply, it's got this sort of snot kind of quality to it. But if we look at its behavior, it's not too dissimilar to this. So I'm going to play this to you. This is cornflour, and it's got a fluidy quality to it. You can see the spoon comes out, but if I bang the spoon into it, it resists, and then I relax, it goes soft. I bang, it resists. I relax myself and the spoon, and it sinks back into it once again. So it's responding to the stress by hardening. If I pull, it's not letting the body, it's letting the body come. If I relax, I can turn the spoon, but then if I force it, it locks up once again. Now, this is kind of interesting, and I think this is kind of interesting when we think about various forms of martial arts. I can see Ed in the picture right now. And these qualities of the surface just under the skin is behaving that way. The superficial fascia has got that kind of behavior to it. Now, when we look at the entire structure of the body, Tom Myers has taken the scalpel to it and created these myofascial continuities here, where we can start to create this sort of tensional quality in the body. And he's done this by almost organizing it like strings of sausages. And what it kind of generates is this potential for what we call tensegrity, where the bones are suspended in a network of myofascia. This creates a much more space. The potential for this when it's well balanced is to maintain space. I've got the dinosaur image up there because a guy called Stephen Levin was looking at the whole fact of how did the dinosaurs' necks stay up? And then you can see Kenneth Nelson's installation at the bottom there. It kind of gives us clues as to how that could happen. So tensegrity, only tension and compression, no levers, bones are hubs, they float in the soft tissue. The ground reaction force is distributed, not locally. And that's the important thing here. It's distributed throughout the entire system. So gravity can pass through you. One is compression only, the other one is tension and compression. So we see the whole body as a tensegrity that way. So Da Vinci was looking at this. Not that he was necessarily knowing that he was doing that. And then finally we get to the foot, which is a tensional structure. And there's a lot of space potential in the foot. And this is where we're going to start to get to some movement in a moment. Here, we've got various tissues on the underside of the foot that are tensioned in such a way that can allow the foot, if you look at the image at the bottom on the right, is that if the foot was to go down, you see the plantar fascia there would accept the load of the foot extending and then try and draw the foot back in again. And there's multiple levels to that. around the back of the foot, you've got the Achilles. And from Tom Meyer's work, we've seen that the Achilles is continuous around the heel to the plantar fascia. Now that gives us a lot of information, because when we get back to that image of that muscle again, and you look at the nature of the tendon, the organization of the tendon in that black and white image has got a crimp-like quality to it, which actually in the Achilles tendon, in the tendons of the hamstrings and various other structures are organized more like a stiffened spring. So we don't want to actually overextend those structures. We look for that spring-loaded quality. It's one of the things that gives kangaroos the ability to move the way that they do. So finally, my father is involved in this sort of training. And this is my dad now in his 80s, and he's a master's athlete. And he's constantly improving with his work. The times he's now running is the same times he ran when he was 76, and he's 83 now. And he got gold in a couple of World Masters events. But also, do we remember to do this? How you meet the ground generates rest, but also do we give ourselves enough time to rest? Finally, can we concentrate our chi? We could just say prana as well, ourself, and bring about a pliability that is that of an infant. So how do we touch the ground? So I'm going to come off the share, because what I'm going to explore with you guys now, I'm going to get my screen a bit bigger, is if you can come to the floor, and what I'm going to ask you to do here is to tuck the toes under and settle the pelvis back towards the heels. Now, this is going to be a preparation for dog pose, and I also appreciate that some of you might not explore dog pose from this beginning. Some people start dog pose from all fours. However, something that we can consider here is when people start moving into a dog pose on all fours, the tendency in moving into dog pose on all fours is to push with the thighs, which sends the body forwards, and then they have to push with the hands to send the body back. So hopefully that makes sense. So what happens is the spine gets stuck in the crossfire. We want to kind of create conditions here that can maintain elongation to the spine. So where the toes are tucked under, my pelvis can rest towards the heels, but I'm allowing the pelvis to settle. And again, as I settle here with the toes tucked under, the plantar surface of the foot is gradually lengthening. We've got the hands resting slightly in front of you. And for some of you, this will be closer than you're used to. So if you don't mind just exploring this as an idea. Now with this, and it takes a bit of time to set this up, usually in my classes, we're going to be spending about 20 minutes setting this up for a while. Can we let the elbow relax slightly? So the elbow crease is facing forwards a little. We're not taking the elbows into each other. We're allowing the elbow to face forwards and let the shoulder girdle drop. So I'm looking to experience gravity. And what I mean by that is that if the ground is something that's pushing, can I come to meet it? So can my hands meet the ground sensitively? Can my knees meet the ground sensitively? Can my feet meet the ground sensitively? And can the pelvis gently drop towards the ground? But of course it won't go any further because the feet are in the way. And we then bring the attention to the breath. The back of the body has more lung tissue in it than the front. In the lab, we call the lungs the organs of the back of the body. When the breath comes in, the spine has a gentle lift to it. And when you let the breath go, the spine is able to drop a little and relax. And through the exhalation, especially towards the end of the exhalation, is where the spine has more chance to elongate without me pulling. So we're spending time waiting. What you'll start to notice probably is that as the pelvis settles, you'll feel more weight and load going through the feet, which just tensions or challenges the foot a bit more. Also, as the pelvis drops and settles back, the crown of the head has more of a chance to move away from the pelvis, and the pelvis has a chance to move away from the head. And this is happening primarily through the exhale. So waiting, softening. If it gets too much on your toes for a moment, just simply come out of it, rest for a moment, relax, and then come back. So there's no rule book that says you've got to stay there over a prolonged period of time. So notice how you settle. Can we have a sense of relaxing here? You've heard about the qualities of sympathetic nervous system, parasympathetic nervous system. So sympathetic being towards fight or flight, parasympathetic being more towards rest and relaxation. So whilst we're here, can we be more towards the parasympathetic side of the scale? Dropping, resting. And then from here, can you just gently extend through the heel? So as the heel extends back, you might find the knees can float a little. So what I'm not doing, and I'll go through this again, what I'm not doing is pushing, I'm sending the heels back and allowing the knees to float. So as I extend through the foot, through the heel, it's the heel extending that's bringing me up. I'm not pushing with the legs, waiting, stay in this halfway position, extend through the heels a little more, waiting, keep checking on the shoulders, soften the spine, open through the ankles and the heels. Opening, so the spine can unfold. Keep opening. So we're not using the thighs. We're not gripping in the thighs. We're keeping the knee joint soft as it opens, maintaining space at the hips.
Now I'm having a look at some of the people that are on the screen here. So, okay. When you come down, I'm going to go through this. So those that are in dog pose, you might just want to come down for a moment. So I will go through this again. We're resting here and we're building tension through the system. So as I'm building tension through the system via the breath, the spine's got this chance to elongate. That increases the tension in the feet. We maintain that tensional edge. So here I can be hovering. It's almost animal-like. Keep extending, so you're still part way. Again, it's animal-like. We're not locking anywhere. Extending, opening, opening, keeping the spine soft, opening, maintaining that length. When you come down, can you keep the distance between the tail and the head? So we're still in this animal-like quality. Keep the heels extending. You're sitting back in the groins until eventually the knees lightly touch down.
See how that goes. We're maintaining a buoyancy in the system here. So I'm looking at Ed. So if Ed starts to extend his heels, if your knee's okay with that, partway, and then we hang out there, keep the elbows soft. So we're always looking to maintain this extension through the ankle and the heel. It's not about the heel going to the floor. If you think about it, your heel is already in some kind of surface because it's the plantar surface that's giving you the support. So all you're doing is extending your heel into the plantar surface. The knee joint opens as a response. Either keep the elbow soft. That's it. So you allow the spine to soften up. Watch the breath, keep the jaw soft, and be attentive to the distance between the crown of the head and the tail. Good. Yeah, it's quite strong. There's a lot of work going on here. I've got a lot of sunlight coming in my room, so I'm going to just have to pull a curtain. There we go. Now then, let's just come down for a moment and I'm just going to show you something here. Here is your classic tensegrity toy. Some of you have seen me use these things over the years. And if I compress this, so very loosely put, the way that tensegrity is regularly described is that the elastic represents the muscles and connective tissue, and the wood represents the bones, and they're suspended in this. There's so much more to it than that. However, if I was to compress this, and then I open it, it's opening in all directions. But if I put this on the floor, and I compress it, and let it go, when I ask my students what happened to it, they say it went up. But when it's here and I do that, it's not going up, it's going out. It's still doing the same thing. It's not going up, it's going out in all directions. It's only the floor that makes it look like it goes up. So when it comes to us moving, can we consider that we're extending in all directions at the same time? I don't need to push against the ground. If I work well with the ground, I've got all the space that I need. But if I start resisting the ground, I've got to work much harder. It's interesting this as well, because the guys on the Sistema trainings in the martial arts thread that you're looking, that you might see, are constantly talking about keeping the system relaxed. I'm looking at Ed here because I've known Ed a long time and understand that quality that he has in his body. You've got to go and see him when he's teaching. Is that the softness in the system is where you get the range from. We need muscle, definitely. But in a way, muscles are acting like brakes and the things that's accelerators and brakes, but not all the time. I don't need them to do everything all of the time. So the body moves in a pliable way, so it maintains fluidity. And it's relaxed as it moves. You see that with animals. You don't see animals walking around tense. So if I'm going to do dog pose, or let's call it leopard pose at the moment, because I like the way leopards do it, is that can we embody what it's like to do that and be that rather than make the shape? You know, the shape doesn't exist in that respect. In fact, your body doesn't know you're doing yoga. You're telling yourself you're doing yoga. It doesn't exist in that way. So we're going to look at this dog pose thing again. I'm going to go through this one more time, but maybe we can come at it from this. Can we be that? So that once more, as I meet the ground, can I rest into the ground? Can I let the shoulder girdle soften? Can I let the legs rest here? The spine can then be free. And if I consider that expansive quality, can it then unfold? So the whole structure becomes light. There's no push. And then it comes back down to the ground once again. There's almost a moment where you start moving into, it's like spontaneous, can't help itself.
Gary, I'll just say 5 minutes.
Great, thank you very much. Yeah, so there's this spontaneity in the movement, expanding from the ground and then coming back down again. So that pandiculation that I was talking about in the presentation earlier, think about it like a slight yawn. What happens to the body when you yawn? You don't contract one thing, it's a whole body event. The movement you're going through now is a whole body event. Can that be considered in every aspect of your practice? Can that be considered when you pick up a child? Can that be considered when you open the car door? Can that be considered in anything that you're doing out there in life? Everything is a whole body event. So, Ananda, I'm looking at you. Just watch what the shoulders are doing, because sometimes the shoulders can try and get overly involved. There's a whole thing we could go in there as well, but we're only just scratching the surface here. But consider that animal-like quality. How would it feel to do that? In fact, what dogs do and cats do and so on when they go into dog is that they open their armpits. And then they go into face-up dog and they open their leg pits. Yeah. So Eva, I'm looking at you with the wrists. There's a whole discussion that we could have about wrists, and these are things that I do on my trainings as well, where we look at the integrity and the tensional relationship from the hand to the waist. Once you can engage well with the waist, you can open the wrists so the wrists don't compress from how you get to the pelvis and the waist. But again, that would be another workshop. Okay, and then gradually come down from there. Perfect. All right, so we'll bring that to a close. Thank you. Okay. So scratch the surface of a huge subject, really. I'm trying to pull all that together very quickly.
Thank you, Gary. So we have time for a question. And are you happy to go to Q&A?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, so got a question about from Hannah about spirals.
Yes.
And she's asking, why in a yoga practice we want to work with spiraling movements? Is it true that we are constructed of spirals?
Well, constructed of spirals is that what we see are more rotational type structures in the tissue. So bones are twisted, they're not in straight lines. Joints are curved, so then they're not touching each other as flat surfaces, they're rounded at the ends. But then when we start to look at how, say, the muscular and the fascial structures are put together, when we start taking that away from the tissues, you start to see that they're moving around the bone slightly. So, you know, the bone might have one particular rotation to it, but the tissues that come off from around it might have an opposing rotation to it. So in any possible way, you start to see curves and rounded type shapes there. So we could say spiral, but it's not a full spiral. Some of the movements might end up as a spiral. We can make ourselves move like that. And primarily that would happen because the ends are curved on the bones and the bones are twisted. So this goes back to Vander's thing, going with the body and not against it. If you can follow those shapes and feel those shapes, the quality of motion becomes much easier.
Thank you. And I think we've got time for one more. And this is about the neck. Uh-huh. And Ash is asking, in my yoga practice, we always have a relaxed neck. We do not use our neck at all to support poses. What are your thoughts on this?
I think the neck is an important part of it because the neck is part of your spine. Your spine starts or ends level with the middle of your ear, the back of the roof of the mouth. The occiput, the base of the skull, is considered to be a vertebral bone. So one of my friends, colleagues and teachers, John Sturt, would talk about the head being another vertebra. So we need to move back within the throat. So those that understand within the yoga world, Jalandhara Bandha, that slight deepening within the throat, that maintains uplift towards the base of the skull. And then the body drops from there. But I understand, you know, sometimes we might just need to let the neck go because one of the classic patterns that we see, and if I just pick on dog pose easily, you start pushing with the arms, the shoulders and the neck shorten. So sometimes it's useful for a while just to have that individual take the neck out of the picture so that they don't keep going to habit. And then we educate them into what the neck really means. Yeah.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
All right, so we've come to the end of your session and I'd like to come back to you in about 4 minutes for a closing. Response from you about how to be more embodied. Now I just want to thank you so much. I wasn't taking part in the poses, but I was kind of trying to think about them in my life. And when you talked about the wrists, I suddenly realized how compressed they were as I was holding my mouse. And what I particularly appreciated about your presentation today was there was the anatomy, that the architecture with the physics about it, but getting that sense of what's the quality of sensation, that fluid elasticity with the images from the animals and the sculpture. I mean, that was just unbelievable. So translating the architecture to that sense inside of fluidity was through, you brought both of those together for me. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Right, okay, so I've just got a few more things to share with the audience about what now. So there was a lot there. I could watch that probably 5 times over. So this recording is free to watch again for 48 hours. And the other ways that you can continue your learning is we have a Facebook group for the conference that you can join. And we have coffee break, which are breakout rooms, and it's all on the website. So you can join those and meet people and share your thoughts and your ideas. And if you enjoyed this session also and want to carry on learning with all the other recordings of the conference, you can buy the full library of all the conference recordings to watch in your own time. It's just not possible to kind of get everything in this 10 days. So I'm finding for my personal development, but also my professional development, is really invaluable. And with the library to buy, you can get the video recordings, but also the audio recordings. So I just wanted to mention that, because I find, particularly for me, I learn a lot when I'm listening to podcasts and that kind of thing, when I'm cooking or gardening or shopping, whatever. So you get audio recordings and you get learning lists. It's a very structured approach to continue your learning. Get notes and recommendations, and it's discounted in the time of the conference. So you can check that on the website. And yeah, if you have been benefiting, it would be it can be a great way to say thank you to the people who organized the conference. And you may want to support people who've not been able, who would not have been able to join for free. We make it free for everyone, and buying the recordings helps to do that for those who can't. So if that's the kind of thing that appeals to you, you may want to consider that. And I would just like to announce what the next session is on this channel, which is at 2 p.m. BST. 3 hours from now. And it is with Linda Sparrow, Yoga for Women's Health. Cool. So that's my wrap up for this session. And Gary, over to you for one sentence on your top tip for our audience for how to be more embodied.
Well, as I said at the beginning, I would say that we're already embodied. So can we remember that and remove the stuff that gets in the way of it?